which infuriated her. But she had been badly frightened, and she knew how close she had come to losing the son she loved. Sefton was generous about it, but it cost him dearly. For him, the matter was delayed, but far from finished. Ottershaw had enjoyed himself enormously, and promised to take Daniel to the best luncheon he had ever had, at some time convenient to him. Daniel raced out, to catch a cab, to the Old Bailey. Chapter 3 Daniel had been to the Old Bailey before. How could he resist it? It was one of the most famous courts in the world, certainly within the British Empire. But he had only been able to visit as a member of the general public. This was an entirely different situation. He was probably not going to say anything, just do errands and take messages for Kitteridge. He would also be looking up legal references and would have to be both quick and accurate. Kitteridge would tolerate no mistakes or delays. Kitteridge was a gangly man, with a most unusual face and a curious taste in neckties or cravats. He'd once been a junior himself, and had worked hard to improve his standing in the firm. He deserved his position, he cherished it, and he believed that Daniel had to prove his worth before he could aspire to anything like it. Kitteridge's father had been a well-respected headmaster of one of the better private schools for boys, but he was very well aware that Pitt's father was Sir Thomas Pitt, the head of Special Branch. Kitteridge felt Daniel had benefited from nepotism and did not approve. Daniel explained to the usher that he was assistant to Mr. Kitteridge, counsel for the defense. The usher looked him up and down with disfavor. "You're very late, sir." Daniel wanted to tell him that he was fresh from achieving a seemingly impossible victory in another court. However, he saw in the man's eyes that no other court was worthy of mention, and instead merely apologized for his lateness. The door opened for him into the packed courtroom. He walked up the aisle between the rows of the crowded gallery without once looking at the judge, and silently slid into his seat in the front beside Kitteridge. "Pitt, where the hell have you been?" Kitteridge hissed at him. "You'd better have a damn good excuse. If you slept in, I'll have your head on a plate. I don't care how late you were last night or in whose bed you slept, you're not at university now. This is reality." He turned away and studied the papers in front of him. "I was in court in Greenwich," Daniel replied. "For what? Drunk and disorderly?" Kitteridge asked with an edge to his voice. "The trial was for murder," Daniel answered. Kitteridge swung around to look at him. "What were you? A witness?" "Appearing for the defense," Daniel said. "And what? You left the poor bastard to swing?" he said with incredulity. "I got him off, with forensic evidence." Daniel kept the smile from his face with difficulty. "Reputation of the firm and all that, as you constantly remind me."
"We are waiting for you, Mr. Kitteridge," the judge interrupted sourly. "May we take it that you have nothing to ask of this witness?"
Kitteridge rose to his feet, biting back his anger.
"As a matter of fact, my lord, I do. My assistant has only just arrived. He was held up by unforeseen circumstances."
"Not another traffic accident, I hope,"
the judge remarked with barely concealed sarcasm. Kitteridge flushed, but he knew better than to antagonize the judge or to attempt humor, although he was not without a sense of the ridiculous.
"No, my lord. I did not ask for details."
"Very wise." The judge gave Daniel a scorching look. "Please proceed. If you need reminding, Mr. Tranmere has just drawn from Major Liddon his professional opinion of the accused and of the victim."
"Yes, my lord. Thank you."
Kitteridge faced the grey-haired man standing to attention in the witness box. He was dressed in a perfectly ordinary suit, such as any gentleman of means might wear, but a regimental tie made it appear a uniform.
"Major Liddon, I believe you live less than half a mile from the home of Mr. and Mrs. Graves, and you were socially acquainted."
"With Mr. Graves, yes. Good historian, accurate, you know, which very few are," Liddon replied.
"Less so with Mrs. Graves?"
"Do not speak ill of the dead. Don't you know that, young man?"
"You speak the truth in court, sir,"
Kitteridge reminded him. Liddon was unused to being corrected, and he didn't take it well.
"I know very little about her. Women like that are a mystery to me. plain man and all that.
Kitteridge was playing a losing hand, and he was only too aware of it. He tried another approach. Daniel studied the jury. It was supposed to be a jury of one's peers. He knew nothing about Graves at all. There had been no time even to take a curious look at the notes last night. He was charged with killing his wife. That was all Daniel knew.
And all London knew that.
What he did not know was what on earth Kitteridge was offering as a defense. To judge by the jurors' faces, it wasn't going over well. Kitteridge tried again.
In fact, you're an officer in the Indian Army, he said, looking impressed. A major?
Retired rank of major, acting colonel, to be precise.
Lydon corrected him with quiet satisfaction.
In command of an entire regiment of men?
Kitteridge asked, with respect.
Yes, sir.
A pretty good judge of men, then. Know who's capable of what, and who will stand their ground under fire and all that.
Lydon would rather have been stripped naked than denied such a thing. He stood even taller.
Yes, sir. I believe so, he replied.
Daniel hid a smile. Kitteridge had made a good opening, but what could he put into it? Pretending to be searching for a piece of paper he dropped, Daniel bent over. In straightening up, he glanced to his left, high up where the dock was, placed above the courtroom, and reached by a different stair. He looked steadily at the man sitting between the warders. Russell Graves was a big man, at least average height, and solid. He was quite handsome, with hair graying at the sides, but still thick. He had a fleshy face, not coarse, but perhaps insensitive. But how could any man be looking his best in a hostile court that had accused him of murdering his wife? He didn't look like a grieving widower. But then why should he show his feelings to a prurient and alien public? Daniel brought his attention back to Kitteridge and Major Lydon. He was eliciting details of the kind man Graves was, his place in the community.
Excellent chap, Lydon repeated. Quiet, not one of those who arrives somewhere and instantly expects to be taken notice of. Too many like that. Think they know better how to run a place than those of us who have lived there all our lives.
Kitteridge drew everything he could out of Lydon's testimony. It proved nothing. He sat down at the end weary and, in spite of his best effort at courage, defeated. They adjourned early that afternoon.
You look asleep on your feet,
Kitteridge said testily to Daniel as they left the court.
You're not much use to me like that. Would a meal put some stuffing into you?
Daniel thought not. What he wanted was about 10 hours sleep.
Yes, he said firmly. I got about 2 hours sleep on Ottershaw's couch last night.
Who is Ottershaw?
Kitteridge asked, matching his stride to Daniel's as they went down Ludgate Hill.
Fingerprint expert, Daniel replied.
Won't need him for this.
Kitteridge shook his head.
Do you know anything at all about this case?
Beyond the fact that Graves is charged with having killed his wife? No, I don't. They turned onto Fleet Street.
We'll go to ye old Cheshire Cheese.
There are plenty of private corners there, Kitteridge said. Daniel looked sideways at him. He appeared tired and disappointed, the beginnings of defeat showing in the twist of his mouth. He was surprisingly vulnerable for one who usually seems sure of himself to the point of arrogance. Kitteridge was losing the case, and he knew it. A defeat in front of Daniel was going to be doubly difficult for him to bear. He didn't lose often.
Do you think Graves is innocent?
Daniel lengthened his stride to keep up.
Not really, Kitteridge admitted. I looked at the evidence and I don't think there's a cat in hell's chance. Then I look at the man and something in me believes him, I think.
He sounded surprised at his own conclusion. Daniel was still trying to think of a reply when they entered Ye Olde Cheshire Cheese. Kitteridge held the door open for Daniel and they found a quiet table. A waiter appeared immediately and welcomed Kitteridge by name. Daniel was determined not to show it, but he was impressed. He was also quite sure that Kitteridge intended him to be.
I suppose I'd better catch you up, Kitteridge said,
since you did not catch up last night, as I had hoped.
Daniel was tempted to say that he had already gathered that Kitteridge was losing, but Kitteridge was becoming angry in a way he had not seen before. Daniel had had the same feeling of near panic only yesterday, thinking he was going to let Blackwell down disastrously. Did Kitteridge care that Graves didn't hang, or only that he, Kitteridge, didn't lose?
What is the evidence against him? Daniel asked.
It's all against him, Kitteridge said with sudden bitterness. His wife's body was found in her bedroom, her skull cracked at the back, and a good deal of her face and upper body burned to the point of total disfigurement. It was appalling. There's no sign of anyone breaking in. No strangers seen by the resident staff, or by the daughter, Sarah, who's 19, or the son, Arthur, who is 16 and an invalid.
He stopped abruptly, staring at Daniel, waiting for his reaction. Daniel looked back at him and saw distress in his face, imperfectly masked. No wonder Kitteridge was afraid he was going to lose. It seemed impossible to win. Why did you take the case? He asked. Kitteridge was ambitious, clever, self-assured. Everybody was vulnerable, but Kitteridge seldom showed it. Or perhaps Daniel was not wise enough yet to see beyond the surface. You wouldn't have? Kitteridge asked curiously. Daniel didn't know the answer to that. He'd taken on Blackwell's case because his father had asked him to, and he had immediately liked Blackwell personally. He liked his quick mind, his imagination, and his throwaway sense of humor. Blackwell was an adventurer, but he wasn't violent. He was a teller of tall stories, largely to entertain more than to deceive. He was generous, both with his means and with his judgments of others. Kitteridge didn't like Graves. That was apparent. Now Kitteridge was waiting for a reply. Well? He asked.
I don't know.
Why did you? Did you have no choice?
Well done,
Kitteridge acknowledged with sarcasm.
How long did it take you to work that out?
I suppose I have no choice either, Daniel replied. Not if you want to stay at Ford, Croft and Gibson and eventually prosper. One day you could be in my position. There was a slight twist in his lips as he smiled, his eyes studying Daniel carefully. When you are in Mr. Ford Croft's position, Daniel finished the thought for him. Precisely. So he asked you to take the case. Right again. Does he think Graves is innocent? That's a very interesting question. The light had gone from Kitteridge's face. Daniel hesitated. Marcus Ford Croft was a friend of Daniel's father, but in what circumstances he didn't know. His mother was not acquainted with him, so it wasn't a social connection. The alternatives were numerous, and not all of them pleasant.
He didn't say.
I got the impression he didn't know, and didn't care, Kitteridge replied. But I've no doubt he wants me to win. He didn't need to add any more for Daniel to understand. The firm was small, but one of the most respected in London. Marcus Ford Croft himself had been one of the best lawyers in the country in his time. Now he was head of chambers, but no longer appeared in court. He was an inexhaustible mine of legal information, and he knew the secrets of three-quarters of London's rich, famous, and infamous aristocrats and thieves. His manner had always been eccentric, but now his memory was as well. He had handed over the litigation to a number of chosen rising stars. Kitteridge was a leader among them, but there were others, young gentlemen who had chosen to follow the law with more or less skill. Time and hardship would determine who became a success. Did he tell you anything about Graves? Daniel asked, since Kitteridge had offered nothing further.
No, Kitteridge said testily,
including why he took the case at all. But I get the feeling that it matters to him. He was not being bloody-minded to see what I would do.
You mean whether you would give it your best shot? Fight to the bloody end?
He meant the bloody metaphorically. Rather than fight a losing cause gallantly, but give in once it looked hopeless.
You're learning, Kitteridge said dryly.
The waiter returned with the menus. Kitteridge took his and passed the other to Daniel. They both ordered, and then Daniel went on questioning Kitteridge. So she was found in her bedroom, her head severely injured, and worse than that, burned. Is there any explanation for that?
No, there isn't.
So a fall or any other kind of accident is out. You can't disfigure a dead woman with fire accidentally.
Male servants in the house?
Daniel tried another tack. A boot boy and the elderly butler who doubled as a valet for Graves.
Gardeners?
Well spotted. An old boy of 70-odd and a couple of lads here and there. None of them had access to the house.
Maids who might have let someone in?
Highly respectable housekeeper, a woman of a certain age?
Kitteridge's smile was very brief.
A cook and a scullery maid, a parlour maid, and Mrs. Graves' own lady's maid. All of them accounted for. Of course someone might be lying, but it would take two telling the same lie, which could be possible, but if you saw them, you'd know it's unlikely. That leaves only Graves, or someone he let in, Daniel concluded, but he made it a question rather than a statement. Bravo, Kitteridge said bitterly. What does he say? Only that he's innocent, Kitteridge answered, taking another sip of his drink. Doesn't he offer any alternative? Not specifically? He has little good to say about his wife. Apparently to him she was light-minded, eccentric, Kitteridge replied. His gaze didn't waver from Daniel's face. He had clear eyes, pale blue, not what one would have expected considering that his eyebrows and his hair were quite dark. He was waiting for Daniel to offer an opinion. Was the man simply curious? Or was he hoping for help and concealing how desperately he needed it? What do you plan to do? Daniel asked finally. Kitteridge sighed. I have no idea. Between now and tomorrow morning, we must come up with an alternative answer, and I doubt Graves will be of much use. Daniel hadn't even seen Graves, and already he disliked the man. What do we know about the victim? Very little. There's a photograph of her. Very handsome indeed. Jet black hair, dark eyes, pale skin. I imagine her parents named her well after she was born, or else she took the name herself. What name? Ebony. Ebony Graves. This time Kitteridge really smiled. It altered his face, suggesting a quite different nature, something gentler and far more conscious of being liked or disliked. Daniel thought for a moment. Have we got anything at all to go on, really? No, Kitteridge replied. So what are you going to do? Reasonable doubt is about all we have left, Kitteridge said miserably. We'll have to think of all the ways someone could have got into the house. That's definitely where it happened, Daniel interrupted. Yes, there's blood on the floor and half the carpet is singed or downright burned. Sounds like hatred. Looks like it, Kitteridge agreed. Whoever did it knew her well enough to have hated her very deeply. He sat forward a little. Graves doesn't appear to be a man who would feel that degree of passion. He's a cold bastard. If she had a lover, and he found out, he'd be more likely to kill the lover than her. If he did that, she'd not stray again in a hurry. This was going nowhere. Maybe if we question him again, he has something to give us, or at least another person to suspect. Daniel concluded a little desperately. What's his reputation locally? Anyone willing to speak up for him more warmly than Major Lydon? A few, Kitteridge replied, but there was no lift in his voice. But he doesn't. He raised his shoulder in a slight gesture. He's good at what he does. He's honest in his dealings, as far as I can tell. He's arrogant, and I don't like him. And I can't find anyone who does. I don't know how to make the jury want to acquit him. Daniel understood. What do you want me to do? As long as I can stay awake. If I knew I'd do it myself, Kitteridge said tersely. Daniel didn't reply. There was nothing about this case that he liked. He could see no way of defending Russell Graves from the charge of having murdered his wife. There was no alternative suspect. They had only reasonable doubt to suggest, and nothing to support it. Suddenly, he was overwhelmed with sympathy for Kitteridge. Right, he agreed. We'd better start thinking. Chapter 4 Daniel and Kitteridge began the following morning early by going to see the accused Russell Graves. They were both tired after a heavy day and then, in Daniel's case, another night with too little sleep. Daniel had taken a cab ride from his lodgings to the Old Bailey. He couldn't afford to risk being late by using the public omnibus. He fully expected Kitteridge to be washed out as well, not only from the long day yesterday, but also with anxiety about fighting when he had so little ammunition, and a very real prospect of losing. It was an important case, and a bad one to lose, because it was highly public, and Marcus Ford Croft obviously cared about it dearly. Why? That was an interesting question. What stake had the old man in the outcome? Or in Russell Graves?
Did Kitteridge know something important that he could not or would not tell Daniel? Something to do with Marcus Ford Croft? The cabbie put him down on Ludgate Hill, and Daniel thanked and paid him. He ran up the large flight of stone steps outside the central criminal court and in through the wide doors. Kitteridge was waiting for him just inside. "Morning," Kitteridge said, barely glancing at Daniel before turning on his heel and leading the way along the wide hall toward the back and the small room where Graves would be waiting for them. They had already discussed their plans last night, actually in the small hours of this morning. There was no more to be said now. Daniel had to stride to match Kitteridge's long steps. The man must have been around 6'3" or 6'4", and loose-limbed, coordinated only with an effort. They came to a door with a guard outside. He greeted Kitteridge, and then unlocked the door. Kitteridge thanked him and led the way in, Daniel on his heels. There was only one man inside. He was large, heavy-shouldered, with a fine head of iron-grey hair. His features were good. Only a greyish pallor and an expression of discontent marred what would otherwise have been a striking appearance. He looked little different from how he appeared yesterday in the dock, except even more strained. Kitteridge introduced Daniel briefly, then sat down opposite Graves. Daniel took the other chair and remained silent. "We haven't got long, only half an hour, so we'll be brief," Kitteridge began. "I will call you to the stand first thing. Please answer me as we have already agreed." "What use is that going to be?" Graves interrupted. He had a good deep voice and a well-educated accent without sounding affected, but his fear showed through in his heightened pitch and abruptness. "I don't know any details that haven't been sworn to by the police, doctors, firemen, and God knows who else." Daniel saw Kitteridge's face tighten and knew that it cost him something to keep his own tone level. "They need to see your reaction to it. Judge your honesty for themselves," Kitteridge explained. "They need to see your grief over your wife's death and hear you say you were not responsible. You know nothing, you have not told the police." "Good God, man, of course I know nothing," Graves said, in ill-concealed exasperation. Kitteridge clenched his jaw. "I know that. They need to hear it."
"You told them?"
Kitteridge's fists were clenched in his lap under the table. "They need to hear it from you." Graves began. Daniel had agreed to keep silent, but now he broke that agreement. "Mr. Graves, sir, it's not only what you say, but how you say it," he interrupted. "They have to want to believe you. They have to like you and sympathize with you. For that, they need to feel some of your grief, your bewilderment at what happened, and believe that you don't know." Graves turned to look at him. "I thought you were here as an assistant." Kitteridge drew in his breath to speak and let it out silently. It was a mark of his anxiety that he let Daniel get away with the interruption. "I am," Daniel replied. "I'm trying to assist you to understand that your life depends on the 12 men of the jury being willing to believe that in spite of the evidence, there is reasonable doubt that you are responsible for your wife's death. Whatever the truth is, all the facts shown so far are against you. We've got this morning to convince them to look beyond those facts and see a decent man, not unlike themselves, who's caught up in a tragedy not of his making. We have to persuade them that they do not want to convict you. They would much rather find a reason to acquit. So they'll look for that reason." Graves raised his eyebrows, but his face was very white. "Are they really so guided by their emotions rather than reason?" There was a certain contempt in his tone.
"I did not kill her. Do you not believe in the justice system you serve, Mr.—"
"I'm sorry, I forget your name."
"Pitt. And no, I don't believe it is infallible. Nobody who has studied the law could believe anything so fanciful. It is run by men. It is subject to all the misconceptions and weaknesses that men have," Daniel replied. Graves looked at Kitteridge. "Have you also such a jaundiced view of the law, Mr. Kitteridge?" Kitteridge did not look at Daniel. "We're dealing with people, Mr. Graves. People make mistakes." Graves looked back at Daniel. "And where did you study law, young man?" Daniel looked back at him without blinking.
"Cambridge, sir."
"Really?" Graves was taken by surprise. And just what is it you suggest I do to get these 12 very ordinary men to believe that I'm innocent? I didn't kill my wife, and I have absolutely no idea who did.
I'm a very busy man, a leader in my field.
I have no idea with whom my wife consorted, who might have wished her harm. Perhaps I'm guilty of pursuing my career to such a degree that I didn't go to parties and local events with her. They bore me stiff, and I cannot afford the time. But I quite see how she might enjoy them, and I gave her an ample budget and the freedom to do as she chose. Perhaps that is something they would not understand. One thing Daniel did understand. How the jury could dislike Graves' arrogance to the point of finding it a pleasure to return a verdict of guilty. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, he said aloud. No, perhaps they would not. You being a man whose time is too important to attend their events. Whatever you think of them, Mr. Graves, said Kitteridge, they have your life in their hands. If you don't want to hang, you'd be wise not to treat them so condescendingly. Their revenge will be all too easy. One word will do it. Graves looked startled. One word? Kitteridge spoke it for him. Guilty.
But I'm not guilty!
Desperation raised Graves' voice almost an octave. Convince me, Daniel said. Graves looked at Daniel as if he were a rather tedious child, who needed even the simplest things explained.
I wasn't even at home. I've no idea who her close friends were. I don't know whether she was having an affair or half a dozen affairs. I don't know if she offended someone.
She was outspoken, even rude. She had unconventional ideas, unsuitable and eccentric friends. She gave her opinions far too freely, regardless of whom she offended. She was a beautiful woman, and dressed to show it off far too frequently. God knows how many enemies she may have made. I didn't restrain her activities at all. Graves' face was sad, and twisted with outrage at the injustice of the situation. Daniel looked at Kitteridge. Oddly enough, it was not exasperation Daniel felt, or even anger at Graves' arrogance. It was something of the same feeling he thought Kitteridge had. A genuine concern that the man might be speaking the truth. And the moment after, the near certainty that the jury would be only too happy to convict him. He saw that same conclusion in Kitteridge's eyes. He also saw that Kitteridge had an idea, albeit a faint one. Kitteridge rose to his feet. We will see you shortly in court, Mr. Graves. We will do our best for you, whether you assist us or not. That is our job. And he walked past Daniel and went to the door. Daniel stood also, still looking at Graves. Whatever he felt, it was his duty to defend him, and it was very much in his interest to please Marcus Ford Croft, whatever his reason for taking Graves' case. His feelings for Kitteridge were more mixed than before. He didn't dislike him so wholeheartedly. It had been a very good dinner last night, and there was a pleasure in working with someone as clever as Kitteridge was. The trial reopened exactly on time. The judge presiding was an elderly man with a thin, ascetic face and a reputation for surprising wit. Daniel fancied he could see traces of it in the deep lines around his mouth. His face might look quite different if he smiled. For the prosecution was Alistair Tranmere, KC. It was a title any lawyer would aspire to. KC stood for King's Counsel. He was a formidable opponent for Kitteridge. Daniel wished he had taken the time to look him up. Not that he was going to do anything but assist Kitteridge in finding the right references at the right times. And it would take a lot more than that to keep Russell Graves from the gallows. In a hushed court, Kitteridge stood and called Graves to the stand. Daniel couldn't help but contrast this with yesterday. Was it only 24 hours ago that he had been in Kitteridge's position, standing in a far lower court, with a gallery filled by a noisy, jostling crowd, trying to save Blackwell's life? But then he had had a plan, and Ottershaw on his side. Kitteridge, with his odd face, his well-cut suit, and his bony hands, looked far more afraid than Daniel had felt. He was facing a pillar of the establishment in Alistair Tranmere, and Daniel would bet a week's rent that every one of the sober, well-fed jury members already believed Graves guilty. Graves crossed the body of the court
and walked with shoulders back and head high to the steps of the witness stand. He climbed up with only one slight stumble when he had almost reached the top. Daniel saw his muscles clench as he grasped the rail. Would the jurors take his attitude as arrogance or courage? What did Daniel himself take it for? Kitteridge began very courteously. "Mr. Graves, you stand accused of having particularly violently not only murdered your wife, but then set fire to her so as to disfigure her face and upper body. The prosecution has not offered any reason why you should do such a thing. Can you tell the court something about your wife? She's not here to speak for herself. I don't wish to harrow your children by asking them to describe their dead mother. It might help the court to understand you and your family better, perhaps more fairly." Graves looked plainly distressed. Daniel breathed out a sigh of relief. It seemed as if Graves would at last defend himself. "What did she look like?" Kitteridge prompted. "We have no way of knowing, since whoever did this to her destroyed her face." Graves winced. The jury must have seen it. "She was beautiful," Graves said quietly, "in an unorthodox way. She had lovely hair, thick and wavy. Black as night. Marvelous eyes. She had grace in the way she moved and the way she spoke. She had imagination, and she was original and funny." Daniel tried to visualize her. For a moment she was alive in his mind, and he grieved that she no longer existed. More than not wanting to lose the trial, he felt impatient to discover what had happened to her. The truth mattered. "Thank you," Kitteridge answered. "She sounds like a unique and valuable person. I imagine she had many friends." Daniel knew what Kitteridge was trying to do. Establish that Graves had loved her. He was playing with fire, but what else had they left to try? "Yes," Graves said. "Was she always wise in the choice of friends?" Kitteridge couldn't keep a certain edge from his voice. Graves was doing nothing to help himself. "No," Graves said flatly. There was curiously little life in his voice. "She failed to grasp that they didn't always like her. I could see that many were hangers-on, people thirsty for excitement. Her way of life, her vitality, her possibility in certain circles drew them in." There was emotion, but also a certain condescension in his tone, in the expression of distaste on his face. Daniel wondered if that was what he truly felt. Would the jury see that too? Kitteridge asked Graves more about Ebony, and then also their two children, Sarah and Arthur. Graves' expression was unreadable as he answered. Had the man not enough sense of his danger to let his feelings show through? Daniel felt he should step in and say something. He could understand Kitteridge's desire not to embarrass the man, but a show of emotion was about the only thing that would save him. Did Kitteridge not understand that? He looked across at Tranmere. Did he perceive the jury's regard for Graves' stoicism and read it as indifference? Daniel tweaked the edge of Kitteridge's gown. Kitteridge ignored him. Daniel tweaked it again, harder. Kitteridge glared at him. "What is it?" he hissed. "Let me try. The man looks like ice," Daniel replied. "You'll ask the same things I do," Kitteridge answered. "You're getting nowhere. I can't make it any worse," Daniel responded. "My lord," Tranmere rose to his feet. "If my learned friend has run out of questions, I'll begin my own." "You will not," Kitteridge snapped. "My associate is going to question the witness." He turned to Daniel again. "This had better be good," he whispered under his breath, as he sat down. Daniel stood and faced the witness. "Mr. Graves, tell us something about the day your wife was killed. Were you at home at all that day?" Graves turned to Daniel, not completely masking his impatience. "No, I was in the London Library for much of the day. I arrived home early in the evening." "Did you see your wife or greet her when you arrived?" "The maid told me she was in her bedroom. I didn't disturb her. I assumed she would come down when she was ready. I had notes to write up before I forgot any of the details that had been told me." "Who discovered your wife's body, sir?" Daniel knew that Graves himself had. He couldn't even imagine how terrible that must have been, were he not guilty. But the jury had to see his emotion, and now was not the time to spare his feelings.
A wave of anger crossed Graves' face. "I cannot imagine, sir, that you do not know it was I," he said, his voice all but choking. "We're not here to observe either compassion or good manners, Mr. Graves," Daniel answered. "This is a place where only the truth counts. Are you telling the court that you discovered the body of your wife?"
"Yes."
"Why did you go to her bedroom when you had not done so earlier?" "It was time for dinner. And you didn't wish her to miss it?"
"Of course."
Graves' patience was tissue thin. "And you found her. Where was she?" Graves' face was white now, and so stiff he had difficulty speaking clearly.
"She was lying on the floor. Her head was near the hearth."
"Did you know immediately that she was dead?" Graves leaned forward over the railing, his body rigid, his skin devoid of all color.
"God almighty, man! She was covered with blood and her face was burned until there were no features left. Nobody could have lived through that."
Daniel hated doing it, but the jury would have to see something other than the cold, arrogant man who felt only anger that they dared to question him. "And you were naturally extremely distressed," Daniel concluded.
"Horrified. Appalled."
"Yes." His voice was almost strangled. "Did you realize immediately what had happened to her?"
I don't know. All I could think of was how she must have suffered. Then I..."
His voice trailed off. Was he going to lose the passion?
"How did you tell your children?"
Daniel asked. It was cruel, but Graves' life hung on it. "Your wife was very close to her children, was she not?" Daniel had no idea if that was true, but it was probable. It sounded good. "I believe your son, Arthur, is an invalid. You must have feared terribly that the horror would kill him." Tranmere rose to his feet.
"My lord! My learned friend!"
He hesitated.
"My learned friend's assistant is leading his own witness. Is this torture necessary?"
The judge looked at Daniel. "I apologize, my lord," Daniel said. "I fear Mr. Graves is suffering a very natural distress, and needed some assistance. It is compassionate." The judge turned to Graves.
"Are you able to continue, sir?"
"Yes. Thank you,"
Graves replied. The brief respite had been sufficient for him to regain his composure, perhaps even to realize what Daniel was doing.
"Do you wish me to repeat the question?" Daniel asked.
No, thank you. That is not necessary. God knows why, but you want me to tell you how I informed my children of their mother's death."
And he proceeded to give a harrowing, even brutal account of telling each of them, and their deep distress. It was all that Daniel could have wished for.
"Thank you,"
he said quietly. "I have only one more question." Graves glared at him. He had been humiliated by having to expose his emotions to this staring, speculating, accusing public. "Did you kill your wife?" Daniel asked.
"No!"
It was an incredulous answer. Almost a shout. Daniel sat down. Kitteridge rose to his feet. He was pale, but totally composed.
"The defense rests, my lord." Tranmere considered for a moment, stood up, said, "The prosecution has no questions for the accused, my lord," then sat down.
"Then you may begin your summations," the judge replied. "We will adjourn for luncheon when you're finished."
Tranmere stood up and faced the jury. He seemed less confident now. He described the brutality of the crime, and the fact that there was no other reasonable suspect. Even Graves himself had claimed to know very little of his wife's acquaintances and could suggest no one. He drew a picture of a very cold, disinterested man and a distant marriage. But that in itself made it seem unlikely that Graves would have committed such a violent murder. Kitteridge took his place and pointed that out. He didn't labour anything but its inconsistency. He reminded them instead of Graves' obvious love for his children, attributing his apparent detachment in the courtroom to his deep care for his wife and his very private nature, which made him uncomfortable displaying his grief for the public to pry into. He also wished to protect what was left of his wife's reputation. Comment in the press had been vulgar, to say the least. The jury retired and the court adjourned. Daniel was not at all sure how Kitteridge would regard his interference.
His instructions had been plain enough. They walked out of the courtroom together, but without speaking. They couldn't go far. There was no way to tell how long the jury would be out. A swift return would almost certainly mean a guilty verdict, but the jurors themselves would at least have lunch. Once Daniel and Kitteridge were out in the street and walking down to the Magpie and Stump, one of the public houses that served a reasonable lunch, Kitteridge spoke at last. "If you ever do that again, I will have you kept out of court for half a year," he said. "But, as it happens, I think you probably improved the situation. We might even have a chance of winning. You've no respect for anyone, have you?" Daniel wasn't sure if he meant respect for Kitteridge or for Graves. He chose to interpret it as if Kitteridge had meant Graves. "He's an arrogant sod. They need to see him as human, capable of showing weakness or pain, like anyone." Kitteridge gave him a quick glance, then looked away again. "He won't forgive you for exposing him like that." "If they hang him, it won't matter," Daniel replied. "And if they find him not guilty, he might even be grateful." Kitteridge gave him a frozen look. "I'm rather more concerned about what Marcus says, you idiot." Daniel had no answer for that, and he decided to say nothing for a while. They had lunch largely in silence, Kitteridge buried in grim concentration on his food, pushing it around the plate and eating very little. He would look up suddenly as if to say something, then change his mind. Daniel ate, but he had no idea what it was on his plate. He had ordered steak and kidney pie, but it didn't taste like anything. Had he ruined his career at Ford, Croft and Gibson? His father would probably be angry. Without question, he would be disappointed. That is what would hurt. He had accepted his father's gift and squandered everything it offered him in one melodramatic and ill-judged attempt at what? Saving an extremely unattractive and publicly guilty man. He looked up from his plate and found Kitteridge's blue eyes directly upon him. "What is it?" Daniel asked. Kitteridge hesitated. "Do you still think he didn't do it?" he asked. "Then who did?" Daniel had previously avoided the question. He was not sure what his own answer was. Kitteridge returned to his meal, pausing a moment to answer. "Doesn't matter now. It's up to the jury." When Daniel didn't reply, he said with sudden savagery, "Do you care about anything? Don't you care about the law?" "No, that's a stupid question. I know you don't. You play around the edges, which is a sin, Pitt, because you could be good at it. Do you even understand that?" Daniel thought for a moment. Kitteridge's question startled him. Kitteridge had talent, but he had worked hard for it, harder than Daniel had. Kitteridge loved it. He loved the idea that law was the elegant but imperfect servant of justice. It was up to them to defend a vision and its errors. It required dedication, and more than that, obedience. "No," Daniel admitted. "I don't see the law first. I see the people." "How incredibly stupid," Kitteridge replied. "You're not supposed to be the judge, you child. You have to serve the law. You are the advocate or the prosecutor, if you ever get far enough for the Crown to trust you. The judge knows the law and sees that we all conduct ourselves accordingly, and the jury decides who to believe. Didn't they teach you anything at Cambridge? Did you actually study?" Daniel was stunned. He had actually studied very hard. He'd had to, in order to pass the exams with a decent degree. He finally voiced the truth that was burning a hole in his head. "You think we'll lose, don't you? And you're afraid old Ford Croft will blame us because they'll hang Graves. You believe he's not guilty because you want him to be, so we'd be justified in getting him off. It might be very clear to win a case like this, but it won't help you sleep at night to think he did that to his wife and you helped him walk away from it. And your restless nights will go on a lot longer than Ford Croft's satisfaction." Kitteridge stared at him. "You bastard." "Is that your best argument?" Daniel asked incredulously. "Shut up and eat your lunch." Kitteridge bent and took a mouthful of cold roast beef and potatoes. Daniel ate too. There didn't seem to be any point in going on talking. He knew that Kitteridge was really afraid, and Daniel might well have ruined the case for him, although he thought it may have been beyond saving anyway. They went back to the courtroom in silence. The jury hadn't returned. and they were still out at 5 o'clock. They would be accommodated overnight and continue their deliberations in the morning. "I'm surprised," Kitteridge remarked as he and Daniel went out into the street. "I thought we hadn't a chance. I expected them to come back after an hour or two. I hope to hell we don't get a hung jury and have to do the whole damn thing again." The next day seemed to drag interminably. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the jury finally returned with a verdict. Kitteridge stood up slowly, as if all his joints were locked. Daniel could hardly breathe. The foreman of the jury was asked, and answered, "Guilty, my lord." It seemed for a moment unreal, as if it had been Daniel's own imagination answering him. Then someone in the gallery started to cough. The rustling began again. The judge sent for the black cap. What a ridiculous charade. What did it matter what he was wearing? The cap was put upon his head, and he formally pronounced the sentence of death upon Russell Graves, to be carried out 3 Sundays from now. Hanged by the neck until he was dead. That would be in 21 days. Chapter 5. Daniel and Kitteridge travelled back to the office in silence. They took a cab so they could get to Ford Croft before he saw the verdict in a newspaper or heard it from someone else. They rode in silence because there was nothing to say. There were no excuses. Daniel faced the truth that the momentary flashes of thought that Graves might be innocent were probably born of pity rather than reason. As Tranmere had said over and over, if not Graves, then who? They had failed to provide a solid, believable answer. Daniel knew that his success in saving Blackwell could be swallowed up by his failure to defend Graves, whom Marcus had personally required him to represent. For Kitteridge, it would be far worse. He was considered the firm's best man in court. It was his responsibility. The fact that Graves was probably guilty was not an adequate excuse. They arrived at the chambers in Linker's Inn and were greeted by the chief clerk, Impney, who read their expressions instantly. It was his greatest skill, along with an encyclopedic memory. "Oh dear," he said sympathetically. "I imagine you would like to tell Mr. Ford Croft as soon as possible. Shall I bring tea?" "Thank you, Impney, it wouldn't hurt," Kitteridge answered. "Yes, sir. Will you be going in too, Mr. Pitt?" "Yes, he will," Kitteridge said without turning around. "Very good, sir." Impney led the way to Ford Croft's door, knocked, and waited a moment, then opened it. "Mr. Kitteridge and Mr. Pitt have returned, sir," he announced, and stepped back for them to enter. Kitteridge went in. Daniel followed and closed the door behind him. Marcus Ford Croft was not physically a large man, but he had a big presence. Now that he no longer appeared in court himself, he dressed to suit his own tastes. He often wore velvet jackets. His shirts were immaculate, but of all sorts of styles and colours, and Daniel had considered whether he might actually be colourblind. He had thick, white hair, which he had cut when he thought of it. The last time appeared to have been some months ago. He looked at their faces, and his own expression dimmed. "Well?" "Guilty," Kitteridge said quietly. "They considered it for a long while, but they found him guilty." "And?" Ford Croft asked. "They sentenced him to death," Kitteridge replied, lifting his chin a little. Daniel did not have to look at him again to know that his jaw was set and his face white. Kitteridge cleared his throat. In 21 days, sir." "I know what day of the week it is," Ford Croft snapped. "He has 3 Sundays clear. 'Tis the law. Then that is how long we have to find a cause for appeal and to get a stay of execution." Kitteridge looked profoundly unhappy. "Yes, sir." Daniel was sorry for him, and sorry that he was here to witness the situation. He thought that was an error on Ford Croft's part, the first he had recognized. You never find fault with a man in front of his juniors. It humiliates him, and reduces his ability to lead. It also makes him dislike the junior, although his colleague may find it as embarrassing as anyone else. "It was my fault," Daniel said, taking a step forward. I tried an experiment, although Mr. Kitteridge told me not to. Graves seemed very cold and arrogant, sir. He showed no distress even when the description was given of his wife's body. I asked him how he told the news of their mother's death to his children. He was very angry, but he did show grief at last. Fordcroft sat still. Against your orders, Mr. Kitteridge? Kitteridge was caught. He hesitated. Yes, sir, Daniel replied. Fordcroft blinked several times. Why, Mr. Pitt? He said at last. I wanted to show the jury that the man was human, just under very tight control. That he was proud, not heartless.
I see, Marcus replied.
Did you think him innocent, Mr. Pitt?
I thought it a possibility, sir, not a likelihood.
That was the truth. Fordcroft turned to look at Kitteridge. And do you support your junior colleague in this, Mr. Kitteridge, or is he stepping forward to take the blame for you?
The colour flamed up Kitteridge's cheeks.
He's taking the blame for himself, sir, and for me, for allowing him to speak up. He cleared his throat. And actually, sir, I think it may be the only thing that made the jury hesitate at all. I think without it, they would have come back in less than an hour, sir.
Fordcroft pursed his lips.
I didn't think you'd work well together. Wouldn't have put you together if I'd had any choice.
Looks as if I may have been wrong.
He turned to Daniel. I thought it was a mistake your representing Blackwell, but your father asked me to have you do it.
What happened?
Not guilty, sir, Daniel said as firmly as he dared. Someone else's fingerprints on the shell casing.
Whose?
Fordcroft asked.
I don't know, sir. I couldn't stay because I had to go to the Old Bailey.
Would you like to know?
Yes, I would.
It was as you thought.
Parks.
The witness was guilty.
Fordcroft's face was unreadable.
There was a quirk at the corner of his mouth. It might have been a suppressed smile or simply a nervous tick.
Thank you, sir, Daniel replied.
Disobedience won't always turn out so well, Fordcroft warned, shaking his head. Well, between the two of you, you have a disaster to rescue.
Sir?
Daniel and Kitteridge said almost in unison.
Only an appeal can save Graves, and it needs to be lodged in good time.
You have 21 days in which to get Graves out of the noose.
20 days tomorrow.
You, Mr. Pitt, know very little of the law. Mr. Kitteridge, on the other hand, is possibly the best student of the law we have in this firm. He knows the law as other men know their own minds.
He ignored the hot color in Kitteridge's face, and the fact that he was acutely uncomfortable.
You will leave all examination of every aspect of the law to him, from every view whatever. Is that clear, Mr. Pitt?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kitteridge?
Yes, sir.
You will examine the records of the case.
You will find if there is an error in anything whatsoever.
Anything. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Dunham is in a plaster cast and likely incapacitated. Nevertheless, if you take in the necessary books, he can research for you. That will give him something to remove his mind from his misfortune. And possibly justify my paying him to sit in his own house. Are you clear?
Yes, sir.
He turned to Daniel. And you, Mr. Pitt, will play detective. Your father was one of the best detectives the London police ever had. Even in Special Branch, he outthought many who would have brought about the destruction of this country's peace and prosperity. You will find out, beyond reasonable doubt, precisely who killed Ebony Graves and how. If possible, you'll also find out why, although that's less important. Daniel drew in his breath to say that was preposterous. Then he saw Fordcroft's unblinking blue eyes staring back at him, and knew that any protest would be taken as rebellion, or simply cowardice.
Yes, sir, he said very quietly.
Well, get on with it. Time's wasting. Fordcroft banged his hand on the surface of his desk. Kitteridge and Daniel turned in one movement and went out the door, just as Impney appeared from the pantry with a tray of tea.
We'll take it in my office, Kitteridge said after a momentary hesitation.
Thank you.
Daniel didn't have an office, just a desk in the corner of the main room. He followed Kitteridge. Impney laid the tray on the desk and left. Kitteridge sat down behind the desk, and Daniel sat in front of it in the client's chair.
Is there any legal error that you can find?
One that would make any difference? He asked.
I don't know. None I could see at the time, or I'd have said, Kitteridge replied. I might be able to find some precedent. There was no life in his voice. I suppose I know several people I can ask. One thing is clear, either there is or there isn't. Your task is a great deal harder. Somebody killed the poor woman, and she certainly didn't burn herself like that by accident, especially since it seemed to have happened after she was dead. A wry smile touched the corner of his mouth. Daniel shuddered in spite of himself. What kind of hatred made you disfigure someone till they were almost unrecognizable, as if death were not enough? He hid it very well. What? How much he hated her? We're trying to prove him innocent, you ass. The jury's already found him guilty. We can't find him innocent if he isn't, Daniel argued. Ford Croft can't be asking us to do that. Kitteridge's eyebrows rose. I think that is exactly what he is asking us to do. No, not exactly. He said to find out who killed Ebony, and not just another suspect. We will have to have absolute proof, and even then, their lordships won't be keen on reversing the verdict. A legal fault would be better. Kitteridge gave a sharp bark of laughter. I don't think there is a fault to find. And to get anywhere, we'll have to have both. A legal fault might earn a retrial. But what the hell difference will that make if he's still guilty? Do you think he is? Daniel asked, watching Kitteridge's face. He saw the shadow, the sadness, and also the desperation, as Kitteridge foresaw his own career jeopardized because he couldn't save a guilty man from the gallows. You don't need to consider that, Daniel said before Kitteridge could speak. You think he's guilty, so do I. But we've got to give this the best shot we can. Mr. Ford Croft must have his reasons for wanting Graves to be spared, and it means he knows something he can't tell us. Maybe for national security or something like that. Kitteridge sat forward. Do you think he does? Why else would he insist on us pursuing this even though the verdict is in? Daniel said reasonably. Kitteridge thought for a moment. What could it be? A debt? A secret? But whose? I've no idea, Daniel replied. But he's protecting someone. We'd better make plans and keep each other up to date. One of us may find something that will help the other, Daniel suggested. Highly unlikely, but we need to try. Kitteridge gave another twisted smile. Where are you going to start? Daniel smiled back, and then said, I'll go see Graves again. He must know more than he's told us. He won't tell you anything, Kitteridge replied. I've been weeks trying to get him to own up. Well, I can't find a hole in the law, Daniel responded. To me, it's as full of holes as a lace collar. For some reason, Kitteridge thought that was funny. Daniel could still hear him laughing as he went out the front door into the street. The sound haunted him. There was so much fear in it, and anticipation of defeat. Daniel went back to his lodgings, although it was a little late for dinner now. He apologized to Mrs. Porterscale, who forgave him as she always did, and made him scrambled eggs on toast and a fresh pot of tea. He ate his meal, still contemplating the case. Where would his father have begun? As Marcus Ford Croft had reminded him, Thomas Pitt had been an extremely good detective. Still was. That didn't mean that Daniel had any of the same gifts. His features and coloring were more like a masculine version of his mother, so he had been told. But his build was tall and lanky, like his father's, and the way he walked was the same. He certainly didn't stuff his pockets with everything he might need one day like his father did. Perhaps he had a little more vanity. He took his tray to the kitchen and thanked Mrs. Porterscale again, then returned to his room and lay back in the armchair looking at the ceiling. He may learn nothing if he gained permission to see Graves. They had no new questions to ask him. Graves had already said he was innocent and had no idea who might be guilty. Had he expected to be acquitted? Would the shadow of the noose now hanging over him sharpen his mind to the reality that no one could save him without his help? It was Ebony Graves who was dead. Someone had hated her. Terribly. Could such a hatred remain secret? Somebody must know. Or had the police been so certain her killer was Graves that they'd not looked very far into her life? What advice would Pitt give? Daniel tried to remember the cases he knew something about, the older ones that were domestic murders. When Pitt joined Special Branch, so much of it